Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize the de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury, but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbass.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazi scum from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to choke off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman, machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbass. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes, and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Pirat on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzeddin and Haja al-Bahdani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc., have also been conducted.
There are seven active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zones' productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar free zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the seven free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large. Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colorful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say
G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also, the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now, G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up. And I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city centre. Instead, they've shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They've just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its, quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim-majority region into two federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings. Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
In the limelight.
More Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2021 than in any other year on record, according to the latest available statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. That included record numbers of both gun murders and gun suicides. Despite the increase in such fatalities, the rate of gun deaths, a statistic that accounts for the U.S. growing population, remained below the levels of earlier decades. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. According to the website of Pew Research Center, in 2021, the most recent year for which complete data is available, 48,830 people died from gun-related injuries in the United States, according to CDC. That figure includes gun murders and gun suicides, along with three less common types of gun-related deaths tracked by the CDC. Those that were accidental, those that involved law enforcement, and those whose circumstances could not be determined. The total excludes deaths in which gunshot injuries played a contributing but not principal role. CDC fatality statistics are based on information contained in official death certificates, which identify a single cause of death. Though they tend to get less public attention than gun-related murders, suicides have long accounted for the majority of the United States gun deaths. In 2021, 54% of all gun-related deaths in the U.S. were suicides, 26,328, while 43% were murders, 20,958, according to the CDC. The remaining gun deaths that year were accidental, about 549 involved law enforcement, 537, or had determined circumstances, 458. About 8 in 10 U.S. murders in 2021, 20,958 out of 26,031, or 81%, involved a firearm. That marked the highest percentage since at least 1968, the earliest year for which the CDC has online records. More than half of all suicides in 2021, 26,328 out of 48,183, or 55%, also involved a gun, the highest percentage since 2001. The record 48,830 total gun deaths in 2021 reflect a 23% increase since 2019. Before the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, gun murders in particular have climbed sharply during the pandemic, increasing 45% between 2019 and 2021. While the number of gun suicides rose 10% during that span across the United States of America. The overall increase in U.S. gun deaths since the beginning of the pandemic includes an especially stark rise in such fatalities among children and teens under the age of 18. Gun deaths among children and teens rose 50% in just 2 years, from 1,732 in 2019 to 2,590 in 2021. While 2021 saw the highest total number of gun deaths in the United States, this statistic does not take into account the U.S. growing population. On a per capita basis, there were 14.6 gun deaths per 100,000 people in 2021, the highest rate since the early 1990s, but still well below the peak of 16.3 gun deaths per 100,000 people in 1974. The gun suicide rate, on the other hand, is now par with its historical peak in the United States. There were 7.4 gun suicides per 100,000 people in 2021, statistically similar to the 7.7 measured in 1977. One caveat when considering the 1970s figures, in the CDC's database, gun murders and gun suicides between 1968 and 1978 are classified as those caused by firearms and explosives. In subsequent years, they are classified as deaths involving firearms only. The rate of gun fatalities varies widely from state to state across the United States of America. In 2021, the states with the highest total rates of gun-related deaths, counting murders, suicides, and all other categories tracked by the CDC included Mississippi, 33.9 per 100,000 people, Louisiana, 29.1, New Mexico, 27.8, Alabama, 26.4, and Wyoming, 26.1. The states with the lowest total rates including Massachusetts, Hawaii, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island. results are somewhat different when looking at gun murder and gun suicide rates separately. The places with the highest gun murder rates in 2021 included the District of Columbia, 22.3 per 100,000 people, Mississippi, 21.2, Louisiana, 18.4, Alabama, 13.9, and New Mexico, 11.7. Those with the lowest gun murder rates included Massachusetts, Idaho, Hawaii, Utah, and Iowa. Rate estimates are not available for Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Wyoming. The states with the highest gun suicide rates in 2021 included Wyoming, 22.8 per 100,000 people, Montana, 21.1, Alaska, 19.9, New Mexico, 13.9, and Oklahoma, 13.7. And the states with the lowest gun suicide rates were Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Hawaii, and Connecticut. Rates estimates are not available for the District of Columbia.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th. What this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maruf from Beirut. Mr. Maruf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria, who was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, what we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League. It's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran, the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria? And why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly, were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting. Now we're seeing the Arab world, led particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure from Afghanistan through Ukraine and their China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League, and for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vessel states like the Saudi country, Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or others that are normalizing with Syria right now will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely, losing its grip. As the previous speaker just said, the United States push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies, like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies and restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. And that's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially, we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel to weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go. And it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be an enemy.
Interesting. So Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead. That there is a struggle between the petrol superpower Saudi Arabia and the gas superpower Qatar, and at the moment the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States. And it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria, and all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria in multiple times over the last 20 somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important also significance for Iran to show, this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And there's a steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah and some of the Palestinian groups. And they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran.